The date is the 14th of May. I'm sitting with Karen Fayer, a daughter of Alexander Raxlin, who's one of the brothers who founded Belfer's Hospital. Okay. And I'm going to hand it over to Karen because she has wonderful information for us.
I hope so. By the way, it's 14th of May, 2012.
Yes.
Because I've done that too. We've got the year.
Thank you.
Anyway, okay. So I'll start at the beginning. The family name is Raxlin. That was the name of my father and his brothers and their family. And that name was anglicized when they came to Canada. It was Reichlin, which is Reichel's son, which is. You know, so I happen to know that name, where the name comes from, but I won't give you all those details. But anyway, they came here very, obviously people left Europe because things were very bad.
And they, approximately, what years are you talking
just
about?
Just after the turn of the century. So I don't know, I've looked for it, I don't know if it's 1902 or 1903, but it's in that general vicinity when they came to Canada. And they settled in Cabbage Town, which was not a Jewish neighborhood. There were only maybe about 10 other Jewish families there, but that's where they ended up, I don't know. My grandfather had what you would call a convenience store. And he had, groceries and a few little deli items and some vegetables and things. And the family grew, and it became 8 children ultimately. And they had my grandfather live with them and a blind aunt. And so with my grandparents, it was like 12 people. Very, very poor. So my grandfather really believed in education. He had been like a Talmudic scholar and making a living was very difficult, because of the times and large family, and he wasn't exactly experienced businessman. But anyway, the school was the main thing. That he had to excel in school, and the person that they held up as sort of somebody they should emulate was my grandmother's brother, who had become a doctor it's Belarus actually, not Russia. It was Belarus, and he had become a doctor, and he was held up to. All the sons, I guess the daughters, they weren't considering them for an education, but to the sons, he was held up as my uncle puts it, the oracle of Delphi. The doctor wouldn't do this, the doctor wouldn't do it that way, so this is how they were, brought up. So they all, except for my oldest uncle who became a lawyer, they all went into a medical profession. My Uncle Sam became a dentist, my father a surgeon, my uncle Ben an anesthetist, and my uncle Saul a family doctor. So that's mm-hmm. That was their orientation. It was, well, of course, I guess to escape this area of where they lived in Cabbage Town, where they were all beaten, they were beaten up, and they were, it was all people, Anglo-Saxons, very poor, but people from England and Scotland and places like that who resented, they were the newcomers and they were resented and they were Jewish and all that. So my uncle says in the, the tape that I did with him, he says, I never thought I was going to stay in this area to practice. He said, we were really, had to fight for our lives here. And I really, had other opportunities to practice outside of this area, but I graduated in 1931, and my Uncle Samuel Raxlin really became, he was the leader. He was the natural leader of his brothers. And my other uncle, the one that was a lawyer, sort of didn't fill that role, but Sam became the leader, and it was a depression. He had to set up a practice. There was very little money, and this apparently a dentist died in the Cabbage Town area. So he had this opportunity to set up practice without spending as much, to establish his practice. So he set up his practice there. Eventually, they bought a house at it was the mayor's house. It was a house that every mayor in Toronto lived in, and it was his office, and that was at Dundas and Parliament. So they had a clinic. It was called the Raxland Clinic. And they all, once they graduated from medicine, they all came to practice together in this building. And then from there, when it became crowded, they built another facility at 500 Parliament, a modern building with, you know, x-ray and labs and physio and, you know, so that was one of the first clinics of that. That was in the early 50s. And shortly after that, I remember my father talking about this too. My father had been educated in Edinburgh. He had a fellowship from Edinburgh. He had his Canadian fellowship. And yet when he came to Toronto, back to Toronto from training in England, in Scotland and Wales.
And that would have been a
place he came back in 1950.
Thank you.
The new clinic was about 1952, I'm estimating. Anyway, so when he came back and tried to get hospital privileges, he couldn't because all the teaching hospitals were, by and large, with a few exceptions, Jews were not able to practice there, and all the downtown hospitals. And so he had to, at Mount Sinai was just getting established. But there was a very political situation there because there was a man by the name of Ben Sadowski who I also had a tape that I listened to by a man called Harold Sandler, who was a contemporary. He wasn't a doctor, but he filled me in on what the political situation was at that time. Now,
The
political situation in the Jewish community.
Got it.
With regard to Mount Sinai. You see, the immigrants had come, a lot of them had come just in the same period, 1900, 1910, mm-hmm. and they had raised families, and then the children of these immigrants, Jewish immigrants, had either become professionals or set up businesses, and then into the 40s, there were a lot of women, Jewish women did this, worked on the communal, organizations. And one of the things was they built a small hospital on Yorkville, which was the original Mount Sinai Hospital. And if you go to Yorkville today, you'll see that the front is still there. And I actually was born in that hospital. So it was quite a small hospital at the time.
That was the original Mount Sinai?
That was the original. I don't know if there was one before that, but that was, I think, either the first one or maybe they would have had something prior to that. But anyway, so this group of, well, there were a lot of men that were, I guess they were collecting money. There was a lot of communal support for the community had grown. This we're talking about, the early 50s. And there was a need for a Jewish hospital. Anyway, they did. There was this man's name was Ben Sadowski. And he was behind it. He had money himself. And everybody in the community contributed, including my family. They did contribute. Everybody did. But he pretty well controlled things, this Ben Sadowski. And I remember my father talking about how he'd gone to talk to him. And Uncle Sam's this in the tape. He went to talk to him. Wouldn't let my father practice there. Or at least, I think maybe all he would get was what they called a courtesy appointment, which was not my father was very well qualified. But there were other doctors who had trained in the post-war years, maybe in the States or whatever. Anyway, he couldn't get an appointment, and I remember my father saying he went to see Rabbi Feinberg at Holy Blossom. They really tried. So I think part of it was that they were, because that's what this Harold Sandler says in this tape, they were really kind of outsiders. Because they grew up in Cabbage Town. They weren't where the rest of the Jewish community grew up, which was more, I guess, around this area, maybe. It was this area.
I think so.
Is around Harvard, and, you know, and they were considered outsiders. They were also, I don't know exactly, but I do know that there was all this resistance. My father operated at a small hospital called St. Mary's, a Catholic hospital on Jarvis Street. And in those days at Humber Memorial, which was like so miles and miles and miles away, in those, I mean, you know, it was Neverland. Anyway, so Sam, who was really a very, very substantial person, very, very intelligent, not just in medical matters, but, you know, he had a dream. And he had a dream that he would build this hospital. He says it's a dream on the tape. I said, I had a dream. He said that I'd build a hospital where my brothers could practice. And he also emphasized that, you know, when we set up this clinic in Cabbage Town, whatever people could pay, we took. We, you know, we didn't turn people away. We never did. So part of the problem, as he explains it, is that these people were very poor. They didn't have a hospital, you know, they didn't have access to other hospitals in the downtown area, like Wellesley Hospital. I asked him about Wellesley Hospital. Well, that started out as a privately owned hospital, and then apparently it was not open to these very poor people that lived in Cabbage Town. So anyway, Uncle Sam got this idea that he was going to build a hospital. And this facility on Brunswick became available. It had been run by the Sisters of St. John the Divine. So it was Catholic, and they ultimately moved, I think, out to John Street or something, and they have it's St. John's Convalescence Hospital, I think that's what it is. Yeah. But they moved, and they sold the hospital. They sold the facility to my uncle and my father and his brothers. And then my uncle tells the story about how...
When would that have been?
That was in the early 50s.
Thank you.
That was like maybe 53. I don't know. I can check on dates. I might be able to get you exact dates. So that was... And then he had to get a hospital license. And he said he engaged the services of Roland Michener, you know, who was a very prominent non-Jewish lawyer. And he says, Mr. Michener was sent to me by God.
Oh.
That's what he says. He was sent to me by God because he really opened the doors for him. Where, you know, he said even when they took out a $700 loan to renovate the mayor's house to make it into a clinic, they had to get a note from their father that they weren't, it wasn't considered that they had enough, you know, it was not secure enough. And they said, and he said, well, my father, you know, I don't know what they thought they were going to get from my father. But anyway, so he describes in this tape about how he went with Mr. Michener to the hospital commission to get this license. And they were very suspicious of him. And he said he was never so badly treated in his life. They accused
Michener.
Him. No. Michener went with him to the hospital commission.
Your uncle was treated poorly.
He said he was treated so badly, they accused him of wanting to do abortions and wanting to do all kinds of, you know, things that were not right in this hospital. And they really gave him a very hard time. And Mr. Michener was there with him. And after an entire day's hearing, he finally was granted the license. So it took a lot, you know. I mean, my uncle was a very substantial personality. I mean, he really was. He was a very strong, strong man, and he was not a pushover. But anyway, so he...
And it sounds as if he was articulate,
too. Oh, yeah. And so he credits Roland Michener with really... And being really there for him, and he says, Roland Michener said to him, I'm really proud of you, Sam. So that was it. So they took over this facility, which was actually, that was on Major Street. It was just on the other side of where they ultimately built. So it was quite an old building. They modernized it, and there were, he says, six sisters, very elderly sisters, that continued to live there till they each one passed away. And they were sort of given responsibility because I guess they were too old to move north.
When you're saying sisters, are you talking about nuns?
Nuns. Okay, Sisters of St. John the Divine. They were nuns. Yeah, they ran this hospital. This hospital.
Oh, so they stayed and
worked there. They stayed. No, they didn't work. Yeah. They were invalids and they stayed and they took care of them till each one passed away.
Very generous.
Kind. Yeah, so they did that. And then there was also, very interestingly, so I told you about the sisters who lived out their lives there.
Kind. Most institutions would not have done such a thing.
But anyway, so then, and there was another very interesting person that was associated with the sisters, was a man whose name was Harry Edwards. And I remember... I remember being told he was a foundling and that but I think he was an orphan, and the sisters had taken care of him since he was a young boy. And so he stayed on. He stayed on at the hospital, and he was eventually, I think he used to sort of repair things, but then he became the receiver. And I remember him being a very, cheerful person. He always wore a bow tie. And he stayed on with the hospital, and he was a legacy. You know, his job came from the sisters too. So anyway, so they so what was happening was that Mount Sinai was built, the building on University was built about the same time, and this Harold Sandler that I taped in 1992 talked about the fact that there was a fishing club in north of North Bay where all 50 prominent Jewish men belonged to this fishing club, and they used to go up and spend time fishing. I don't know how often. And so the subject of the Doctor's Hospital and the Raxlands came up. And I think that Ben Sadowski, and my uncle, I recently talked to him about it, did not appreciate that there was this other hospital. Although they didn't have Jewish patients, that was the thing, because their practice had been centered in in the East. They didn't have Jewish patients, but there were Jewish doctors that started to come also to the, and a lot of course, ethnic doctors as after the war, when there were, many Europeans coming to Toronto. This was a place where all these, these doctors from Europe, who I guess had to retrain to some extent here. And so it was kind of like, I think that what I gather from this Harold Sandler, that this was sort of like, they resented that these Jewish doctors had set up this hospital, and so there was this kind of a very negative kind of tension. I don't know, but that's what I gather from this reviewing of this tape that I made with Harold Sandler, who was one of the members of the fishing club. So anyway. So then, very shortly after they opened this, this old facility, they built another wing coming towards, and they would acquired the land, on Brunswick. So it spanned, from Brunswick to Major. They acquired the land there, and they put up another addition. I don't know how many beds it had. But then that wasn't sufficient, and then they put up a 10-story addition, which was right fronted on Brunswick. Oh yeah, and I forgot to say that there was an old chapel in the facility that had been run by the nuns, St. John the Divine. And this chapel was used as a lecture hall, one of the things they did. And the other thing, because my Uncle Sam was very interested in art, all of the brothers subsequently, except my Uncle Saul, who died very prematurely at 47. He used to, they used to have shows there. And the artists let the artists show, and then they would get some kind of commission for putting that up. So that was another thing that my uncle talked about on the tape, and how I vaguely remember that. I remember going to that. It was a very lovely little chapel, and they, you know, they kept that. And anyway, so that was another thing they did, a little innovative.
That they kept the nuns. They kept this other man who worked for
them. Oh, he was a very excellent.
And then the chapel for art exhibits.
Yeah, yeah. No, so it was
much more than just a hospital.
Well, it was. Well, it was interesting because they originally, the very first year, they were a private hospital. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they became a non-profit hospital. So they had a very intermediary status in between public hospitals. And then there were a few private hospitals like Scholdeis. You know, the Scholdeis was private.
Yes.
And they were non-profit. And I know it was very, very difficult that their negotiations with the, you know, that they were funded by the government. At that time, I think there was hospital, you got hospital, you could get hospital coverage. I don't remember exactly when hospital coverage came in, but I do know that it was very, very difficult. And I remember my father saying to me, this is like a tiger that you get on. It's easy to get on it, but you can't get off. And so it was not easy because they had a different kind of relationship with the grant, you know, the government that granted, you know, the money. And I know it was complicated and it was not easy. Now, one other thing that I'll tell you that is quite charming is about my grandfather. My grandfather had been a very, very, he was a big walker. He used to walk for miles and miles and miles. Anyway, when they opened up the hospital, he took it upon himself to go, and he would, as my uncle describes it, he would come to the hospital early in the morning and have breakfast. And then he would, I don't know if he started in the bottom or the top, but he would visit every single patient, every single patient, and they all thought he was rumored he was the owner.
Oh.
And they would make their complaints. They didn't like the food, or they didn't like this or that. And then he would go and report to my uncle, my uncle uses the example that this woman said she's getting chopped fish every day and she doesn't like the taste. And then it turned out she had a gallbladder problem and that's what she had to eat. And so, you know, he described, but I remember my grandfather making these rounds. And my uncle says he even inspected the kitchen. But this is what he did. He was already in his 80s. And this was the thing. The people said he was the owner. I remember hearing that myself.
So he was treated with respect.
Yeah, oh, yes, yes. But he was also, they also felt free to make, you know, complaints to him about what was right, wrong. Anyway, so
he had a good time doing this.
Yeah, he did. He liked it. He was very friendly. Yeah. He was very friendly, yeah. And people responded to him. And anyway, and he would take these complaints back to Uncle Sam gave up dentistry, and he was the hospital administrator. He worked as the hospital administrator. And my father was head of surgery. Uncle Ben, but there were many other doctors. I mean, it became quite a lot of doctors. I don't know exactly how many. I think Uncle Sam says 200 or something.
Ooh.
But I, you know what, I can't, it's not totally, he was about 84. And I, you know, I wasn't sure whether, when he did this, you know, when he did this interview.
How many were full-time or how many had practice?
They were on staff. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. They were on staff. They weren't working there full-time. So that was, you know, this thing with my grandfather was interesting. I do remember, this is quite engraved in my memory, but I do remember when they were putting up the 10-story addition, my father went down to look at it. They were building it, you know. And I remember, I don't know how we got up there, but we were up on about, not right on the ground floor, but up higher, I don't know, maybe 4 stories, I don't know. And there were no walls. We're just standing up there. He took us up there to look. So I don't know. That was sort of my first memory of the you know, the hospital as it was going up.
As it was just being. Yeah. What year was that?
Oh, jeez. Okay. What years? I think it's 57, but I can verify. I can get you those dates. I think it might be around 57. Not sure. And then, of course, I remember the openings. You know, they would have the Minister of Health come and open the hospital and make speeches and whatever. I remember that. And I have some pictures of that. I actually have given them to the Jewish Archives, but I can get copies of them.
Please.
And I actually used to work there on my holidays.
At the hospital?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
I did. Well, I was once in the gift shop. Yeah, they had a gift shop. They had a women's auxiliary, and they had a gift shop, and they, you know, raised money for the hospital. And then I was, at one point, I was on the information desk. Not by myself. I don't mean by myself. But I was on the information desk. And then at one time, I even did ECG tests. They taught me how to do it. I was in university, I guess, by then. So I did, you know, so I did work there. And so it was... I'm trying to think about what else. I don't know if
did any of you ever live in this neighborhood or that
no.
was the hospital?
No,
here?
No, we never lived in this neighborhood.
And
no.
What was it like for the brothers to be working together year after year?
Oh, well, they were, as a matter of fact, this Harold Sandler is very critical of them, but they were very much a clan. Mm-hmm. They weren't a family. They had grown up literally sharing beds. They were really so poor. And there was no time. They all had jobs. You know, packing ice, selling newspapers, selling vegetables, selling eggs. They really, their only playmates were each other. And so, and then when they grew up, they were just the four of them. And then afterwards, when Saul died, the three of them. So they. Very much, this was their whole life, was just being together, really being together, and so it wasn't a difficult thing. They all got along. This was they were like a clan. I've always said that. They were like a clan, not like a family. So, and that's how they were, outsiders perceived them, like this, in this tape that I was reviewing.
Like a closed
door. Yeah, who were they? They came from out east, and they were always together. And they didn't. They had some other friends. My parents had, but essentially, they worked with each other. They were best friends with each other, and it was all. I think it came from this living in this neighborhood where, you know, they had to sort of fight to you know, that they were attacked, you know, for being Jewish and for being immigrants or whatever,
both,
and then so and sort of like Sam says that. He never would have considered going off and practicing somewhere else without his brothers. He had to, you know, they all had to stick together. And they did for all their lifetimes.
And Sam was clearly the leader.
Oh, Sam was
the negotiator.
He was very much the leader. He was the ideas, the vision.
Yeah.
The vision. And he was kind of, he had a brother-in-law that lived in New York who was a doctor. And he used to go back very often. He and my Aunt Rose used to go. And I think he was, you know, I think that's where he was got interested in art and where he learned about, you know, hospitals. I can't say for sure, but I do know that he had quite a bit of sophistication as well as being highly intelligent. And my father used to say, like, he says, I don't know where Sam gets these ideas. I think he's up in the middle of the night. He had a lot of, you know, he was able to... come up with these how to do things. Oh yeah, then he says he for the financing for the hospital. I think that the bank didn't want to, you know, wasn't keen to lend him money, and I don't know how, but somebody from Edmonton, some financier from Edmonton, financed the big hospital, the big 10-story building, and he somehow got in this. Guy just had trust in him. I mean, he was a very persuasive man. He was a very very, quite an amazing person. I mean, I wouldn't want to be on the other side of him. But he was a very, you know, he had a tremendous, he had charisma, he had force, he had, you know, and he was the one that dreamed this up and made it happen. And so it was, and then ultimately the hospital was designated as a place like for, I remember there were Mexican doctors that came to train, you know, to get their, you know, more, I guess, more extended experience. They were sort of the house staff, you know, the residents, and the, so they had that, you know, they were given that, they were asked to do teaching, they taught, but they didn't have, I don't think they had like the regular, they didn't have the regular,
so they didn't have
of,
residents
no but they did have they had these, they had these people from yeah that were coming from other places, so they did that.
Was it always called what
it was? Did always it called the doctor's
it
house,
was always called.
Except when it was it was St. John's. Mm-hmm. It was the St. John's, now I don't know what the, was it called. It was called St. John's Hospital, but I don't know if the, maybe I haven't got the title exact, but when it was run by the nuns. And that was, you know, the first, so essentially three, the first building was very old. It was, and I can try and find out when it was built, but that was the one run by the Sisters of St. John the Divine. And then they built another smaller addition attached to that, and then they ultimately built this 10-story building. So it was quite a, and then next door they built an, a building for doctors, office building. They had an office building there next door, a separate building.
So that would have been for
private, for doctors, you know, to have their offices.
So they could rent that out to other doctors.
Yeah, so doctors had all their offices there, and then they, you know, could use the, oh yeah, and this is what he said, they had the first, he said they've had the first, or I guess sick kids had the same thing, but you could bring a sick baby there, you know, like they had sort of an outpatient for babies, for children, a pediatric thing. They did that, and I'm trying to think what else. I can't recall right now, but that's, you know, so it was kind of an audacious thing to do. You know, really.
Very courageous.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. And there wasn't, you know, there was this, like I say, you know, there was this thing that went on with, you know, I guess my uncle, maybe he, one of the reasons he started the hospital was because that my father, who was so qualified, who had a fellowship from Edinburgh, and had a Canadian fellowship, and he couldn't get a, you know, a substantial hospital point. Well, part of it was that, you know, that Jewish doctors couldn't work.
Yeah.
But so he wanted his brothers to have a place to practice, and that's what he did. So it was quite an accomplishment.
And when did they all stop working around the same time? What was
he says in the tape that when he was 60, he was required to step down. That's what he says in the tape. My father died that same year, and then
what year was that?
That was 1969.
So one brother was 60 and had to retire. Your father died.
My father died, and then Ben retired. And Saul had died at 47, very young. So, and then I think it was sold to Extendicare, but then they I think the government, anyway, it became a public hospital. It ultimately, that, you know, it became a public hospital. And they had owned the land. They had owned the land, not the hospital. They had owned the land, so that's what they sold, was the land. So that's how it happened.
Did your father talk much about practicing medicine here and the difficulties?
Well, he certainly talked about how difficult it was to run the hospital. He definitely talked about that. He talked about, you know, all these negotiations with the government and how they, you know, had a lot of difficulty. I think it wasn't very strict. It wasn't easy. But my father was, you know, my father was not, like Uncle Sam was more involved in the administration, whereas my father was a surgeon, and, you know, and he was pretty well engrossed in that. But it was, I think they had, you know, they really had a sense of, you know, achieving something. I mean, after all, they had come from really, I mean, virtually in their home in Cabbage Town. They didn't have heat and they didn't have hot water. And it was
now this generation you're talking about, your father. Yes. Were they born in Europe or they
no,
were
no,
born
they
here?
Were born here.
They were born here.
But my grandparents and some of my great grandparents came. But you know, they
But
really
it was
had,
real poverty and then they
oh,
ended
real
up.
Poverty. And then they really by they had to work very, very hard to have the clinic. And then ultimately to build the hospital. But I think Sam was, he was very unusual in having that kind of drive, I think. You know, that drive and that energy and that vision, yeah. You know. So he, I'm trying to think what else there was about it. Anything else?
Now, of course, it was a very generational thing. You said that there were 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls?
There were 5 boys and 3 girls. And the girls did not get
an education. Well, that was that generation.
Yeah.
And what about your generation? Did any of the fathers promote medicine for their children,
well,
male or female?
Yeah, well, Sam's son is a doctor, a psychiatrist in the States. My brother, I think my father wanted him to be a doctor, but he was not inclined, and it didn't. And some of the next generation are doctors, but in that my generation, I guess only my cousin Bernard. Oh yeah, my cousin, my aunt's son, Edward, is a doctor. So I guess there are a few. Yeah. But anyway.
It's really a very remarkable.
It is remarkable.
It's a remarkable story. Yeah. I mean, not that they had so much education because those were the values, but what they built.
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
above and beyond.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that there wasn't just one. You know what I mean? They were a team.
Yeah.
They were teams, so they had a lot more, you know, maybe more than, it was easier maybe than for somebody that was an individual.
Right. So it was kind of power in numbers, but also that one uncle was so clear and he was a leader.
He was the leader. He was a remarkable person. I mean, you could have an argument with him and he would take any side and he would win. You know, it was very forceful. Yeah. He was forceful. I'm not saying he was easy. He wasn't. He wasn't, but he was a force.
Yeah.
He was a force. And I think maybe the fact that they had been, you know, that they had been targets in this, you know, in this neighborhood. I don't know. And part of it was that my father, you know, came back with his qualifications and they were perceived as outsiders and they couldn't, they went to see this Mr. Sadowski and, you know, and tried all this, tried for my father to get, you know, get an appointment where he could. And it was also, Sam said that, you know, these people where they were practicing were really so poor. They didn't have the means to go to, you know, hospitals. They couldn't even pay their doctors. It was a very tough time for people, you know, to pay for before, you know, if we had socialized medicine. It's very difficult for poor people to access the system. You know, they had a really hard time. So it was a combination of things. And I guess, they really were quite amazing. But I think it was the team thing, the family thing. And then other people sort of didn't understand or thought it was difficult or thought it was unusual. Like this Mr. Sandler in the interview, he says, well, I used to see them at Oakdale. And they were always together. They didn't play golf with anybody else. He says,
very tight family.
Very tight. He says, they always played golf together, and there were three different shapes. I don't know. I don't think he liked them that much. He says, well, there was the tall one who was thin, then there was the medium one, and there was this short, stubby one. That was my father. So he says, and he didn't understand. They didn't. And maybe it was, he says, because they got off the same, you know, they had to take time off together. But he didn't understand. They didn't play with anybody. Even their brother-in-law played by himself. They didn't even play with him. So I think they were viewed with, you know, there was this perception of them as maybe different or clannish, mm-hmm. or whatever it was, but it brought them together, but it made them stronger.
Yeah. And who was Mr. Sandler? How did you come to him?
Oh, well, Mr. Sandler. Okay, Mr. Sandler, because he was my mother, after my father died. My father died in 1969.
How old was your father at the time?
He was 60. He was only 60.
So he was young.
Yeah. Anyway, so my mother remarried a number of years later, and she and her husband used to go to Florida, and they used to be friends with this Mr. Sandler and his wife for, you know, many, many years. And so I don't know how, when I was visiting my mother, and I don't know how it came up that I found out that he had been an observer. He was an observer, and he, you know, so it was really good to get his point of view, because he'd been a member of the fishing club, and he had, you know, he knew what the doctors said and what this Ben Sadowski said, and he, you know, and he, well, he really put down the hospital. He says, oh, you know, it was just this little house on, he says, it was a little house on Brunswick. Well, it was never a house. It was maybe this old facility from, you know, the nuns hospital. But it had never been, well, they did acquire houses. And I remember one was where the interns and residents lived, you know, these foreign students from Mexico. And I don't know, maybe there were other places. So there was a tension there that, like even when I was speaking to my uncle who's 97, my uncle Ben who's still alive, he said, you know, it was sort of a thorn in their side, because, you know, there was another place where Jewish doctors could go, you see. So there was a lot of under the surface, or maybe above the surface, things that were going on. But I never quite understood, because my father said he went to see the rabbi, and he went to see Rabbi Feinberg, and he went to see Ben Sadowski, and he could never get this appointment. So in a way, this Harold Sandler gave me another perspective, because he said, you know, they were like outsiders, and they were always together, and so maybe they didn't have ties in the, you know, in the broader community. You know, maybe that was it. And that as outsiders, they had to, you know, had to make a place for themselves. So, yeah. Anyway.
Did you have any feelings when as the next generation, right. But Doctors Hospital was major in your life. What was it like for you when that hospital was raised and...
Well, I felt badly. I felt badly that, you know, that they had built this and it was, you know, gone.
Yeah.
And it became very much a community, you know, I'm sure you remember, it was a community hospital, and it was very important in serving all the ethnic groups of people. And you know, they spoke different languages, and they really were very accessible. Well, at one point, there was a fight to save it. Remember, they were going to, I don't know if you remember, they were going to tear it down. So, and it had become integral in the community, in serving the community.
And it really was a community hospital for all the different ethnic groups.
Yes, right. So I felt badly. Yeah. I felt badly, you know, that it was gone. And, you know, it was kind of sad.
Well, it was a huge part of your life.
Yeah, it was. I felt very badly. I felt very proud that my family had done this. I thought, you know, how remarkable, you know, when you consider, you know, what their origins were and how they... How hard, you know, when my uncle describes how hard, like how, he says, as children, we worked all the time. And they didn't really have time for friends. Between studying and working, well, you know, when they had they worked in the store, they worked, you know, they gathered coke to burn in the, you know, he and my father installed
a furnace. They got a secondhand furnace. They weren't plumbers, and a water heater, and that was when they got heat and hot water in the house. He says they used to go to three on. I actually have a video of my uncle, but anyway, three penny bathhouse where they used to have. That's where they used to get clean. So you know, when you think about the contrast and how what a remarkable. Remarkable kind of accomplishment. It is very, you know, and I always felt very proud that that was my family and they had done this, you know, amazing thing.
Well, they started with nothing. They worked hard all their lives.
They did.
Then they created this community hospital because I didn't grow up here, but by the time I got here,
I was
very aware of that.
Yeah, it was. So, that you know, it was. It served, it didn't serve just the Jewish community. I mean, they had, it served a broader community. There were some Jewish, you know, there were doctors, a lot of different doctors, and some of them were Jewish, but they had patients. They didn't all have Jewish. I think, and Mount Sinai eventually became, you know, it's a general hospital. It doesn't just cater to Jewish patients, but it catered to, you know, to the community in the area and a place where these doctors who had come from Europe and, you know, retrained and where they could practice and bring their patients and, you know, so it was
bringing young doctors from Mexico to train them too.
I don't know how that happened. I don't know whether it was the government that did that, but I do know, and I don't know whether there were other countries too. I just, you know, my uncle mentions in the tape, he mentions the Mexicans, and I recall them, but I don't remember whether there were, I could ask my uncle if they were from, you know, if they came from any other places too to train.
But just that alone is unique.
Yeah, that they were, you know, helped them. I guess they went back. I think they went back. They weren't staying here. They were, you know,
training,
getting extra experience or whatever it was. And, you know, that's what happened. So, you know, so anyway.
I would definitely appreciate whatever pictures you could come up with.
Well, I see if they'll copy them for me. They should at the archives. I have quite a few pictures. I have a big newspaper article. I decided, you know, if you leave them and then, you know, when something, you go, I go.
Yeah.
My children wouldn't keep them. They would throw them away. So all those kinds of things I give away. You know,
yeah.
I gave them away a few years ago, you know, to the archives. Although I found a few more and I have, so I can, I don't know whether they'll release them or I could maybe get copies. They might do copies for me. I think that they would probably do that.
Well, a few of them, that would really show the street or just
there were actually some publicity shots that they had done at the time of the big
edition.
And
pictures of course, the brothers, your
right.
father and
Well,
brothers.
I don't know what, I have a manila envelope with some of the pictures that I found after I made the donation. So I haven't given those yet. So I don't know. I'll look in there. And then I'm sure they would be, you know, probably agreeable to letting me.
And, you know, I don't need a lot of them.
No,
but
no.
Just
how many
some
would
that
you
are
like?
Sort of representative.
How many would you like?
Oh, I'd say maybe eight.
Eight?
Does
okay.
That sound
okay.
Reasonable?
I'll see if I can.
So
get
that. So if you can choose some for us, and then our history committee could decide which we would.
Right.
Might,
okay.
Might
well,
use
I'll
for
see
the
if
display.
They're going to charge what they're going to charge if they're going to charge to make them, or.
Unless I could go make some copies.
Yeah, well, let me see. Let me speak to them, and I'll see, because I signed a release and everything, so.
So they belong to them now.
Yeah, they belong to them, so I have to really check with them. Although, I do have some that I found subsequently that I can definitely, you know, let you have those to copy. Yeah.
Oh, a very, very rich history.
Yeah, it was.
It's your family. Your family going from. Not quite rags to riches, but
it was rags.
Yeah,
it was rags.
Sure.
It was rags because I think literally the clothing was made out of sugar sacks. I mean, it was like, and my uncle, of course, and everybody in the family talked so with such admiration about my grandmother, who was this selfless woman who, you know, raised on nothing. You know, there was no food. And then in those days, apparently there were a lot of things that the butcher didn't sell, and that's what they lived on. Liver wasn't sold, intestines, spleen.
So that's what they ate, I'm sure.
They ate that. And oh yeah, and I have the most incredible description from my aunt, because I also have my aunt, talking about how my grandmother served 8 children and the blind aunt and the grandfather and themselves on 1 chicken. And how, and I have the most marvelous, marvelous description of her talking about that. So the heroine, the heroine was my grandmother. I mean, she used to pack lunches for each of them, and they all got to have their choice of what they wanted, and she would wrap it with different color string. I mean, no, she was very selfless, and she really asked for nothing for herself.
How long did she live?
She was, I think she was about 76. Mm-hmm. And I got her death certificate a number of years ago, and it said, there was a question. My father filled out, you know, the deaths, it's his handwriting. So it said, what was her occupation? And so my father wrote, housewife. For how long? And he writes, forever. And my uncle said that in this tape that I was listening to, he said, she was such a selfless person, I decided that I would do whatever I needed to make sure that she got, that she had something. And indeed, you know, they bought a lovely house for them, and they, you know, took care of them. She didn't live that long because she developed heart. My grandfather lived longer, but... And my father told me the story about how they had a hospital bed at home, and, you know, and she had a nurse at home, and she was like, you know, I guess had
so
heart failure.
Yeah,
heart failure and everything. And she had some, I guess, another heart attack, and he was putting in some IV or whatever he was. And she said to him, she said, can't you see I've had enough? And she tore out the IV. She says, can't you see I've had enough?
Yeah.
So she, you know, so really in this whole story, you know, they do talk about my grandfather, but you know, when they really admired her in such a tremendous way that she was very smart. She was very, very smart.
Well, and she had 12 people under that roof.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Can you imagine that she was feeding and caring
and
for
one bathroom? I'm sure.
I don't know how many bathrooms. And a blind aunt that she couldn't, that who had glaucoma, and she had gone blind from glaucoma and couldn't, had to, she had to lead her around. I mean, it's monumental what she had to do.
You know the expression "Eshet Chayil"?
No, what's that?
It's a woman of valor.
And she really was. She really was. So, yeah. Anyway, it's quite. Quite remarkable. Unfortunately, she mostly spoke Yiddish, and I really couldn't converse with her. I remember her, but she always would say Yiddish things to me. And my parents used Yiddish as their secret language, I never understood it. They just
and they kept it that way.
They kept it that way, so I have no Yiddish except a couple of expressions. Yeah. But that's so I really
but,
couldn't talk.
But you still learned her value.
Oh,
yeah.
Very, very much. Very, very, very much. Yes, definitely.
I'm going to turn this off.
Okay, fine.
I just want to say thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, I hope
interesting
it's
and full of information.
Oh, I hope so. Well, I did some work. I did listen to the tapes, you know, the CDs that I made. So I had more to say than I would
thank
have.
You. Thank
anyway,
you.
I'm glad that you were able to get the story down.